look to the side over there and speak with him and have the resources that we need. We already have everything that we need for life and godliness, is the way Peter actually phrased it. Because that's true, we're able to walk in a way that's worthy of that calling. People who have those advantages should expect that their lives would be transformed, absolutely transformed by those advantages. And eventually, as we continue to make our way through, by the time we July rolls around here, we'll be talking about taking our stand against the evil one and being able to push on the darkness, expecting that the darkness will push back, but being able to put together a more powerful push against the darkness than the darkness is able to lay against us. This is part 45, titled Do Not Provoke Your Children to Anger. I love that title. I'm sure that some of you don't, but we'll try to prosecute that before the time, you know, before we're done. And it's coming from Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Once again, I want to start out by saying that I know you're accustomed to my starting with a review, which sometimes has that effect on people. But we're facing the same sort of issue this week that we faced last week. Last week, we got together for the purpose of talking to the children after 4 weeks of talking to husbands and wives about the way they do life. So in talking to the children and focusing on the children, it didn't seem reasonable or proper to take time to review what we had said to the husbands and wives over the past 4 weeks. And now this week, we're going to be talking to the parents after talking to the children last week, and that's why I'm disinclined to provide you with a review. But I will say this. The next time you face a situation where your child is inclined to disobey, I would suggest that you take out the balloon that you've been carrying in your pocket and just start blowing it up, because that would make an excellent review for what we talked about last week from the beginning of Ephesians chapter 6. As a small review, though, I want to remind you that Paul has been, ever since the beginning of chapter 5, Paul has been speaking to us about pressing issues in our lives and told us not to do this, but to do this instead. I hope you picked up on that pattern, because we beat it to death by the time we got there. But he's going to follow that same pattern this morning and the next couple of Sundays as well. He'll tell us that we shouldn't provoke our children to anger, but we should instead bring them up in the training and teaching of the Lord. So we're going to break verse 4 in half and cover the shouldn't this week and the should next week, and then reserve the right to expand to either the should or the shouldn't, or maybe both, the week after that. We're going to have 3 weeks on parenting. Originally, I'd planned to get that done by working through a few of the 31 memos this Sunday and a few more next Sunday. 31 memos is that parenting seminar that we've used here at the Potter's House over the years. So I took out a piece of paper and I divided the 31 memos into two columns. On one column, I had a list of the memos that speak to this issue of not provoking your children to anger. And on the other column, I had a list of the memos that speak to the issue of, or the idea of bringing them up in the training and teaching of the Lord. And when I finished making those two lists, I was surprised to discover that 16 of the memos were on one side and 15 of the memos were on the other side. So they were divided right down the center, as much as you can divide 31 right down the center. But I got busy trying to sort out which two or three. That was my idea. I'll just, you know, cover two or three of the memos from the first column, and we talk about those this week, and then two or three of the memos and that we would talk about next week. And I tried to do that with my thinking cap on. But by the time I had blown the third fuse on my thinking cap, I realized that probably wasn't going to happen. I couldn't imagine which three to use as we took that time. Because it occurred to me as we walked through the book of Ephesians here that if I were to take as much time talking about parenting as I'd like to take, then I would end up breaking my promise to you of finishing the book of Ephesians this year in 2020. So I settled on something, and I hope that's okay. Well, it has to be, because it's, you know, my notes are here. What am I going to do? But this Sunday and the two that follow, we'll just take the time to work through the introduction to the third seminar, seminar number 3, relative to parenting, to the 31 memos, because that's the seminar especially that talks about being worldview-driven as you teach and train your children. So if you were here for some or all three of the seminars, then I'll ask you to cut me some slack and forgive me for not being able to avoid following my heart as I took on this opportunity this week and the next two. To get started talking about being worldview driven, we need to read the passage that's out there in front of us, the passage that we'll be unpacking. And so if you would stand with me, we can read aloud together from Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. And by the way, the verse that's up there, on the screen, is a combination of the Modern English Version and the New International Version. I don't usually do that, but I hope it's okay again that I decided to do that this week. So if you would read aloud together with me, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4 says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the training and teaching of the Lord." Thank you. You can take your seats. That's going to be our verse for the next 3 weeks, today and the 2 weeks to come. We know that God's already blessed us with every blessing and a spiritual blessing in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus. And so we're glad to read his word, even when it describes something to us that hardly seems possible. Of course, I want to tell you a story from God's Word this morning. I always do. And there's a story that resonates with me when it comes time to talk about parents raising their children. And this story is going to actually serve us this week and for the next two Sundays. I don't know that I'll repeat it all three Sundays, but, well, you have to come and see how we manage to do that. But the story is about three guys named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it comes from Daniel chapter 3. And with that brief background, this is the story from God's Word. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had grown up in Jerusalem, but had been taken captive, taken prisoner, and transported to the Babylonian Empire when Babylon invaded Israel. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon, during that time, and he was not a follower of the one true God. He was, in fact, an idolater, and one day he commissioned the creation, the building, the completion of a golden idol that was actually 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. And they set it up in the plain of Dura, or the Dura plain there in Babylon. And he ordered that all the leaders of Babylon come to the dedication of the idol. That's what he told everybody that they had to do. And that meant that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have to show up at this thing. They were required to attend and participate. Now, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were young men who were followers of the one true God. And so this order from the king put them in some potential jeopardy because they had to attend and they were required to respond as the king instructed them. So the day came when the entire group of leaders from across Babylon found themselves standing before this massive golden idol. The king then ordered that these instructions be given. The instructions be given to the entire crowd, and they went something like this. In a moment, you're going to hear the music start. And when you hear the music start, everyone on this plane, everyone here, is required to bow down and worship the golden idol that the king has set up. And then a warning came with it. Whoever does not fall down and worship the idol will be thrown immediately into a blazing, fiery furnace. So the music began to play. And everyone bowed down in front of that idol there, except Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They continued to stand. Well, word soon got to the king that they had made that decision, that they had stood instead of honoring his laws, honoring his decree, worshiping his God. So he sent for them, and he was furious as they stood before them. And he asked them, "Is it true that you don't serve my gods? Is it true that you refuse to worship this idol that I've set up?" And then without waiting for an answer, the king went on to say that he was willing to give them another chance. "I'm going to have the music play again," the king said. "And when the music starts to play, if you bow down, then I'm willing to forget about this whole thing. But if you don't bow down," the king said, "I swear you will be thrown immediately into a fiery furnace." Then the king asked them, "Once you've been thrown into that furnace, what God can save you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, rather than allowing the music to be played again, they decided they'd save some time. And they said to the king, "Oh, king, we don't need to defend ourselves in this situation. We don't need to defend our actions here today. Because if we're thrown into a blazing, fiery furnace, then the God that we serve is able to save us from the flames. He's able to deliver us from your hand. But King, your majesty, you need to know that even if he does not deliver us, we will not bow down. King Nebuchadnezzar's fury just boiled over, and he gave an order that the furnace should be heated 7 times hotter than it had ever been heated before. He asked his strongest men, the strongest soldiers in his army, to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and carry them to the mouth of the furnace and throw them in, wearing their clothes and their turban and with their hands and feet bound. The strongest men in his army carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over there and threw them into the fiery furnace. They tied them and threw them into the furnace while they were still wearing the robes of their office. The king's command was so urgent, and the furnace was so hot, that the men who threw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the fire died because of exposure to that heat and flames. And finally, the king, content and aware that his orders had now been followed and this descent had been pushed down, sat down on his throne there on the Dura Plain and began to relax. And then suddenly, he leapt to his feet, jumped to his feet, and he shouted to his closest advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we put bound, we tied them up, and we threw them into that furnace?" "Certainly, king," excuse me, the men said. "Then why do I see 4 men, Nebuchadnezzar said. "Why do I see 4 men walking around in the flames, and one of them is like a son of the gods?" Nebuchadnezzar carefully approached the mouth of that furnace, and he called out to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come out, come here to me. Come out of that furnace." They stepped down out of the furnace, those 3 men, and they made their way to the king. As they passed between people along the way, the people that were closest to them noticed that the flames had caused no harm to their bodies. Not a single hair of their head had been singed, not because they were like me. Their robes were not scorched, and there wasn't even the smell of smoke about them as they walked by. Nebuchadnezzar then praised the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego for sending his angel to protect those 3 young men who had defied his decree and were willing to risk their lives rather than worship or serve any God other than the one true God. And that's the story from God's word. Many truths that we could draw from this story, and I hope by now you know that that's what I try to do on a Sunday morning. I tell a story that's related to what it is that we're trying to learn, and then we pull the truth out that story illustrates. But there are many truths that we could draw from this story, but there's one truth in particular that leaps out of the page, jumps out of the page when I read it, and it burns in my heart when I tell it. These guys were the real deal. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not pretentious. They were not pretending. They were the real deal. At the crucial moment, when their faith was put to the ultimate test, they stood firm. They stood for what's true. Now, I know from experience that not everyone in every church has heard the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Sometimes I'll ask, I won't this morning, but sometimes I'll ask, how many of you knew going into the story how the story was going to turn out? And there isn't always, not always every hand goes up. Never, not everyone knows that story. And I want us to keep in mind that the day that these events unfolded, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had not heard the story either. They didn't know how it was going to turn out. They didn't know how it was going to end. And I say that because of what they said to the king. We know that our God can deliver us, but even if he does not deliver us, we will not bow down. They knew that that was a possibility. They were not at all sure that God would show up and show off. They were hoping, I'm sure, but in other words, they were not as sure that it would happen as we are today that it did happen. And this tells me that these 3 young men were not going through life counting on the fact that bad things wouldn't happen to them. But despite the built-in uncertainty, they had already made the decision that the key thing in their lives was their undivided attention to God and their worship of his name, and they were willing to risk everything in that pursuit. We face similar situations every day, though usually not as consequential as being thrown into a fiery furnace. I can't remember the last time somebody in authority threatened to throw me into a fiery furnace if I didn't, you know, do a particular thing. Maybe you've had that experience. But I'm talking about little situations and little issues when we have a chance to take a stand or a chance to deny and back off. When your boss, for example, begins to put you under pressure to do something that you know just isn't right, like Nebuchadnezzar did to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that day. And I don't mean to be accusatory, but we so often bend in the direction, where did that come from? We so often bend in the direction of convenience. We make the choice by saying, this is not the wisest thing to do, and it's not the most helpful thing to do, but doggone it, it's the easiest thing to do, so I'm just going to go with it. And when it's a small issue, that's not such a big deal. I can say that with confidence. But when we make a habit of bending in the direction of convenience, of taking the convenient way out when we face small issues, then we can develop the habit, long term, of taking the convenient way out even when we're facing larger issues that have the capacity to change the course of the rest of our lives. That happens. We have no control over when something like that is going to happen, because major life issues don't come with a warning label, and they don't come with a spoiler alert. That's never happened to me. I've never had a major life issue break at 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon after having heard from God at 8 o'clock Monday morning that this thing is going to happen. It's going down today, Jay. That's never the way my life has ever worked. If you've got a deal like that with God, come and talk to me, because that would be so cool. They don't come with a spoiler alert. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not know that they would walk out of that furnace the end of that day. And that seems to be nowhere more true than when we're talking about our children, when it comes to our children. So personally, for my own life and situations, this tendency that I have to take the convenient way out when my own faith is challenged leaves me with a question. What am I willing to risk to be the real deal? What are you willing to risk to be the real deal? I had an experience in the Philippines a number of years ago. I was speaking at a church in Metro Manila that had 3 morning services, and by the time I was done with the first of the morning services, because you don't get to speak less than 55 minutes there. That's what they require. So, you know, it's a lot of work by the time you're done. Got to the end of that first service, and I desperately needed a cup of coffee. That's all. The only thing in the world that I wanted was a cup of coffee. So I went to a nearby Dunkin' Donuts, and yes, we have Dunkin' Donuts in the Philippines. We're not savages, for crying out loud. And there were donuts in the case, and there was a coffee machine behind the counter. So I knew that I had come to the right place. So I leaned into that lady behind the counter that just smiled at me, and I said, here's what I need. I need 2 plain donuts and a large cup of coffee. That's what I want. The lady behind the counter bagged the 2 donuts and handed them to me and then told me what I owed. And I said, wait, I kept my cool. I said, thank you. But what I really need is 2 plain donuts and a large cup of coffee. There's 2 plain donuts in the bag, she said. I know, but there's no large cup of coffee in my hand, I said back to her, and starting to lose my cool. And she said, well, we don't have any coffee. And I said, well, that's okay, because you can just make a cup of coffee, you know. And I pointed to the machine there. And then she said one of the worst things that I've ever, ever heard in my entire life. That coffee machine is for display only. Wasn't for sale. It was just there for display. It was for display only. All the parts were there. And I should have been able to get a cup of coffee, the cup of coffee that I so desperately needed. I probably mentioned that already. But the machine was only for display. It looked good. It looked good on the outside. But it wasn't able to do the main thing that a coffee machine is supposed to be able to do, make coffee. And it strikes me that the same thing is true today of many people who call themselves Christians. We show up and we pay our dues every Sunday at church, but when the moment comes to dig deep and sacrifice in some way or take a stand, we stop short. It's time to put up or shut up, to step up or stand back, and we let the moment pass. We look good, but there's no inner reality. We're not the real deal. were for display only. In Isaiah chapter 29 and verse 13, the Lord has something that he has a comment that he wants to make to those who claim to be his people. The Lord says, these people come near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their hearts are far from me. Their worship of me is made up only of rules taught by men. God's talking about the kind of people who are willing to conform outwardly for the sake of impressing other people, but for whom there is no inner reality. God's talking about people that we might call religious. In other words, they're not the real deal. They're for display only. But even more importantly for our time together, God is observing that his people weren't relationship-driven as they approached him. You remember what it said there in that verse. They weren't relationship-driven as they approached him. Instead, there were rules. They were rules-driven in their approach to God. They could have been seeking a relationship with God, but they chose instead to spend their time keeping rules that had been made by other men, by other people. Rules that have to do with how we relate to God. And what's true about the way that those people related to God can be equally true about the way we relate to our children and ask our children to relate to us. Because for some parents, it's all about the rules. But in light of what Paul is telling us this morning, I'd like to suggest something to you. We must be relationship-based in our approach to our children instead of rules-based, especially as your child grows into the mid-teen and late teen years. Because for a teenager, and I'll say this and duck, mom and dad, but for a teenager, there is nothing more frustrating than when a parent fails to make that shift right there. We're talking about taking a different approach with your children than the approach that's normally recommended in parenting books, because we're talking about making an inward rather than an outward approach to your child. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to ignore the outward. We're not going to ignore his behavior. But we're not going to ignore the outward issues in the lives of our children. It means that our approach will sometimes be outward, especially when they're small. But even when they're small, our approach will always be based on the child's inner needs. And that's in an effort to avoid frustrating your child. Obviously, we won't ignore what his body needs, but our primary focus will be on what his or her heart needs. In other words, as your child grows from toddler to teen to adult, you must learn to pay more attention to the inner workings of your child than you do to the outer workings of your child, even though the outer workings are the most obvious. And as they grow, we need to make the transition from discipling our children to teaching, not discipling, disciplining our children to teaching our children. In other words, as your child grows, you need to make the slow transition to where you are focusing less on discipline and more on teaching. And that's especially true of your child as your child gets closer to being an adult. To get there, we need to talk about the difference between an inward approach rather than an outward approach to your child. And that means that we need to talk about the inner workings of your child's heart. In other words, we're going to learn to focus less on his or her behavior and more on their hearts. We need to understand that taking an inward approach to a child will always bring outward results, but an outward approach will never bring inward results. And that's because truth and change move from the inside out, from the heart into the behavior. They never move from the outside in. And that's something, by the way, that's true in every relationship that we have, not just the relationship that we have with our children. When we begin to talk about the inner workings, we're talking about core issues. We're talking about the deepest motivators of the human heart. When we talk about the inner workings, we're not talking about the stuff on the outside that everyone can see, or even the stuff that you can see. We're talking about the less visible stuff down underneath, the stuff inside. We're talking about the inner stuff that makes me do the outer stuff. We're talking about heart issues. And so when we're talking about adjusting the inner workings of your child, we're talking about speaking to your child's heart. And I admit that speaking to your child's heart may sound sappy and artistic to some of you men, some of you who are dads, maybe even, I don't know, silly. I don't mean to sound, but if you'd like a more scientific approach, then I'll say to be successful in your approach to your children, you must be worldview driven. And I know that that sounds like psychobabble right now, but I'm trusting you'll understand what I mean more fully as we go. Your child's worldview shapes the way he or she looks at life more than any other single factor. I mean, that's the definition of worldview. Your child's worldview also shapes the way he or she responds to life and life's challenges. And by the way, your worldview shapes the way you respond to life's challenges and opportunities, but, well, we didn't come here to talk to you. Your child's worldview, or talk about you anyway, your child's worldview plays the key role in how your child turns out as an adult. That's what worldview is. His worldview drives his beliefs. His worldview drives his values. His worldview drives his behavior. And as I say that, I'm assuming at least trusting that you want your child to share your worldview. You want your child to share your beliefs. You want them to behave, share your values, to behave in the way that you hope that they're going to behave. And that's why it's important to understand that their beliefs, their values, and their behavior are all driven by their worldview. And that means whoever and whatever shapes your child's worldview will at the same time shape their beliefs, their values, and their behavior. That's how it works. This is where it can get a little scary, because there are a whole lot of things out there that shape and contribute to your child's worldview. Their friends shape their worldview. If your child is 9 years old, then his or her 9-year-old friends are shaping the way your child looks at the world. Television and movies shape the way your child looks at the world. The nightly news shapes the way your child looks at the world. Instagram and Snapchat shape the way your child looks at the world. The whole internet, for goodness sake, shapes the way your child looks at the world. Advertising shapes the way your child looks at the world. School shapes it. And of course, you, mom and dad, shape the way your child look at the world. But unfortunately, we live in the information age. And I know that sounds like a good thing, but that means that there's so much information finding its way to your child that you're forced to spend more time being reactive that you hardly have any time to be proactive. Think about it. Your child spends 1 hour watching television, another hour dividing his time between Snapchat and Instagram because his time is limited, screen time is limited, and then he spends another hour with his friends, and now it's time to go shoe shopping. Yeah, shoe shopping, one of my favorite things to do with my kids. You tell your son that you've budgeted $50 for his shoes, but as you go into the store and before you begin looking, he already knows what he needs. He needs that shoe that's on the altar right there in the center. Right there in the center of the store. Those are the shoes that he needs. He needs that pair of shoes that are in the center of that display. Then those shoes happen to be $150. Not $50, but $150. Dad, you need to get those shoes for me because I need those shoes. I need those shoes, he says to you. So you say to him, you don't need those shoes. You want those shoes. But those shoes are $150, and you only have $50 to spend. So if you want those shoes, what you need is another $100, and you ain't going to get it from me. And you kind of smile to yourself, and then you think to yourself, I can hardly wait to get home and tell his mother how clever I was right here in this shoe store. She's going to enjoy this. She really is. You see, you think you're being clever because you are. You're being really clever. But I can guarantee you that your son, your teenage son, is not thinking to himself, gosh, my dad is so clever. That's not how he's looking at this situation at all. Because as you generously offer to give him $50 to buy shoes, in his mind, you're not being clever. You're being cheap and stingy. Because he needs the ones that are $150. And by the way, other kids' parents, his friends' parents, have already caved to that same pressure. And all of that's happening because someone else went proactive in your child's worldview. And you were forced to be reactive. In other words, you were already losing the race before the race began. And that's never a good place to be when it comes to your child's worldview. What we're trying to say here is that you must react to what your child says and does. But if reaction is the sum and substance of your interaction with your child, you will always find yourself on the defensive. That's what you will always be doing. Because by its very nature, reaction forces us to be after our child's behavior. We're paying more attention to his behavior as we react than we are to his or her heart. And if all you're doing is reacting, then you will always be looking for a way to make up lost ground. Always be looking for a way. Because when you're reacting, you're not able to build your child's worldview. You're only able to fix your child's worldview. And you'll always be a day late and a dollar short, or $100 short in the case of the shoes. So we're talking about being proactive besides being reactive, and that means teaching your child, not just disciplining your child. We're talking about making an inner approach along with making an outward approach, and that means speaking to your child's heart, speaking to his or her worldview, talking to him or her about core issues. And this is where it's time to say that the thing that many of you have heard me say before, by the time your child is 12 years old, the way that he looks at the world, his worldview is 95% in place. What I'm trying to say is that you should be the one to shape your child's view of the world. You should be the one. And because if you don't, you can be sure that someone else will. He's not going to reach adulthood a blank slate if you don't write on it. That's not how it works. And if that's the case, if you let him reach adulthood with that worldview in place, you may not like what your child becomes as a result. So if you want to truly shape a child, you have to shape their worldview. Let me explain to you where I'm coming from. My training is not in child rearing, and I am certainly not a child psychologist by any stretch of the imagination. I am, however, fairly well informed about cross-cultural ministry. Haven't traveled much lately, but those of you who know me know that I'm on the move internationally all the time, and I've been doing this cross-cultural thing for more than 40 years, so I should know something about it. But I cut my cross-cultural teeth with a group of headhunters in the Philippines, and I wish I had time to pause and explain to you how they look at the world, but if I did that, then we'll never get out of here. Well, we'd get out of here in time for bed, maybe, but you remember that I just said that if you want to truly shape a child, you have to shape their worldview. And the same thing is true when you're working with tribal people, when you're in a cross-cultural ministry. If you're going to communicate cross-culturally, you have to learn not only to speak the language, but you have to learn to speak to the worldview of the people group to whom God has sent you. If you want to reshape them, you have to reshape their worldview. And that means that you have to know how they think and how they look at the world before you begin to teach. You have to understand. What's true of people from other culture groups, other people groups, is true of your children as well. They look at life very differently from you. Have you noticed that? They believe differently from you. The things that they value are different than the things that you value. They behave differently from you. And if you're going to help them to get from where they are to where you are, you have to be the first to understand where they are. A child is like someone who's lost in a maze. If you're going to help them find their way out, then you have to look for them. You have to find them. You have to go to them. You have to lead them out. You have to find you can't stand on the outside of the maze and say, here I am out here. Here I am. Because they're in a maze. They can't find their way out. They can't find you. You've got to go looking for them. You have to go to the center where they are and lead them out. Lead them from where they are to where they need to be. I mentioned that we worked with headhunters, and during my time there, I was busy growing the churches, and all during the time that I was there, God was busy with something else alongside our ministry. He was growing our family right in that context there, in that tribal setting. He sent 3 children into our lives, and if you know them, then I don't have to tell you that every one of them was unique. I knew that there were things that I wanted to teach my children, so I began to have conversations with them. At first, they couldn't talk, so they didn't make any sense, but then amazing things began to happen. I still remember the day that David, sitting at lunch, our 3-year-old at that time, asked a profound question. Dad, why do we have fingernails? I don't think I'd ever considered that question or the answer to that question prior to that particular moment, but I knew I couldn't ignore it. I mean, I would have dearly loved to have ignored it, but I heard myself saying, well, we have fingernails because we're always bumping our fingers on stuff when we pick them up, and our fingernails protect the ends of our fingers when we pick up hard or heavy things. I haven't had many moments in my life when I've been impressed with my innate wisdom, but I was at that moment. I was pretty impressed with myself that day. I mean, nailed it. See what I did there? Nailed. You guys. Anyway, that would have been the end of it. But David wasn't one of the boys that was inclined to let things go. 3 days later, fully 3 days later, we were sitting at lunch again, and David got that, hey, wait a minute, look on his face. Because he just stopped chewing, and he asked, as though we'd been talking about fingernails now for 3 straight days. Sitting there, he stopped chewing, and he looked at me, and he said, then why do we have toenails? Obviously, he wasn't in the habit of picking up heavy things with his feet. But I had an answer for that one, too. Go away, kid, you bother me. My son was looking to me to answer questions that the most profound questions in his life. And when you're 3 years old, why do we have fingernails, is a pretty profound question. He came to me at a time in his life, listen to me, he came to me at a time in his life when he was prepared to accept the answer that I gave him. But that was the day that occurred to me that the way that I viewed the world and the way my children view the world are different. My children and I were coming at things from very different perspectives. In fact, the cultural gap that existed between the headhunters and me was very like the generational gap that existed between my children and me. And I found myself thinking about my children that they didn't behave like I did. They didn't value what I valued. And they didn't believe what I believed. Not yet, anyway. But I wanted them to. I began to wonder if what I knew about teaching and training across a cultural gap would have any information to offer, any help to offer when it came to teaching and training across the generational gap. And in light of that fact, I'd like to suggest something to you today. If you're more than 15 years older than your child, and I won't ask for a show of hands, but if you're more than 15 years older than your child, you're ministering cross-culturally. Your child's culture, the culture that your child is growing up in, is different from the one that you grew up in. So they have the questions and you have the answers, and the primary goal of parenting is to connect those two. We have to find a way to appropriately answer their questions during the brief period of time when they're willing to listen to what we have to say. And that goes away sooner than you think. Sometimes the questions are funny, but sometimes they're poignant. I was playing Barbie dolls with my daughter one day, and yes, I'm proud to say that I spent a lot of hours playing Barbie dolls because I had 2 daughters. Still remember that day when we were playing with Barbie dolls and my daughter asked me a question. Daddy, I play with Barbie dolls with my friends, and we dress them up, and then we have a beauty competition, and my Barbie never wins. Daddy, why does my Barbie never win? That's a question that's on a whole different level than why do we have fingernails. Teens ask even more poignant questions. If Jesus loves me, why can't I get my locker open when I'm late for class? If God cares so much about me, then why did my grandmother have to die so close to Christmas? And adults ask powerful questions too. There's a 30-something woman whom I was counseling with years ago who had been abused as a small child. And her question was, where was God when all of that was happening to me? Those are profoundly important questions. And they should have been answered when they were first asked. They should have been answered for them the moment the event was unfolding. But somebody slipped up. Somebody didn't do their job. Somebody was asleep at the wheel. Was it Dad and Mom? I have no intention of putting you on a guilt trip today. If I've succeeded at that, forgive me. But I do want you to know that your children are looking to you for answers to life's most profound questions. Sad part is you may not even be aware that they're asking the questions. Next week, we're going to put a picture of your child up on the screen, and that picture looks like that right there. Now, some of you don't think that that looks too much like your child, but some of you are aware of what it is from the parenting seminars from 2016, but I'm asking all of you to keep that image in mind, in the back pocket of your mind, and we'll pick it up again next week. We've come to the end of what we're able to finish in the time that we have today. So I hope you'll come back over the next 2 weeks as we continue working through these things. We've already talked about the fact that our children don't behave the way we try to behave. They don't value what we value. They don't believe what we believe. But we want them to. And what we've been trying to say is that if you want to impact your child on that kind of level, then you're going to have to begin speaking to their worldview. You're going to have to learn to listen to their hearts and speak to them on a heart level. Irma Bombeck is famous for saying a lot of things. She was a very funny but deeply profound lady. And of all the things that she said, I think this one is my favorite. The decision to have a child, how awesome. It is to decide forever after to have your heart go wandering around outside of your body. And as the father of three children who are either in their 40s or approaching their 40s, I can tell you that that is something that never changes, even if your three hearts wander as far away as the other side of the world. So someday, your children, your heart, is just going to wander off. And I would remind you that not all those who wander are lost. But if your children are still living at home with you, then you still have time to go wandering around in their hearts before the day comes when they wander off with your heart. And if you're going to wander around in their hearts, then I hope that what you want to do is to teach them and train them in God's ways without provoking them and driving them away from you or from God. We'll be diving into that again over the next 2 weeks, and I hope you'll make a point of being here for that. But in the meantime, I want to read this very simple verse one more time before we go our separate ways. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4 says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the teaching and training of the Lord." Will you stand with me in the presence? Father and our God, we thank you today for the goodness that you show us every single day. We thank you again for the fact that when you tell us to call you Father, you really mean it. Ephesians has already told us, Paul's letter has already told us that every father on the planet gets his name from you, the fatherhood of God. So God, I pray that you would help us to realize that every time our children bow their heads and say, Father, they think that you are someone very much like Dad. God, as a father, that is the most intimidating thought I have ever faced. I pray that you'd help us to navigate that intimidation with your grace and your goodness and your mercy as you bring those things to bear so that we can learn to stop provoking our children and bring them up instead in the teaching and the training that's about you. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we have the play all laid out. We've huddled up. We're headed out there, and dads, and I haven't said mom yet, but what's true for dad is true for mom because you guys are one, right? And so you're going to go out there, and you're not going to provoke your kids anymore this week, right? Yeah, okay. Well, we'll deal with some more with that as we go, but you will be bringing them up in the teaching and training of the Lord. And so since we've huddled up, all that's left is for me to say, ready? Go get them, Potter's House.